Seeking mental health care can be overwhelming and even scary, but it doesn't have to be. I'm Dr. Josephine McNary, and I'm committed to making this process easier for you. Each week, my expert guest and I unravel a different form of therapeutic intervention in order to bring comfort and understanding and to help you get back to your true self. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Mind Stories. Today, I have the honor to speak with Dr. Neil Shearholtz. Dr. Shearholtz is a licensed psychologist who specializes in treating adults holistically with character, analytic, and ergonomic therapy. I know that's quite a mouthful, and I'll be getting into what that means during my conversation with him. Along with treating depression, anxiety, and trauma, Dr. Shearholtz specializes in treatment-resistant personality disorders. He helps people heal from their own chaos, harshness, low self-esteem, and social inhibitions. The focus of his work includes dismantling and gaining lasting freedom from the unconscious defenses that hold people back from having the life they want. He sees individuals and couples in his office in Los Angeles, as well as offering appointments remotely. Welcome, Neil. All right. Well, welcome, Dr. Neil Shearholtz, to our podcast. And today, it's great to have you on. Excited to talk about your specialty in terms of ergonomic therapy. Welcome.
Thank you, Josephine. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah. So do you just want to, I think it would be great to just begin by you just giving a little bit of a background about your work and how you work with clients.
You know, you mentioned ergonomic therapy, and for your listeners, they may likely have never even heard that. This is based on the work, the theory and practice of Wilhelm Reich. Reich was Freud's protege, very much both exalted and reviled among psychoanalysts in the 20s and 30s. He was very much considered Freud's golden child, but he fell out of favor for a lot of reasons. And he is really the father of somatic psychology, meaning working with the body, the soma, and body-oriented psychotherapies. So all body-oriented psychotherapies from bioenergetics to Hakomi to somatic experiencing, which is currently in vogue, all are offshoots of Reich's original works, influenced by Reich and from his original teachings. So the work that I do is close to Reich's original way of working, close to his theory and practice. That's what I've been influenced by and how I've been trained, which means in addition to talking with my patients, and, you know, as most of your listeners would know about, I also work with my patients' bodies with hands-on intervention, meaning I am physically manipulating the hypertonic muscles, the body armor, instructing the patient in a way of vocalizing and breathing, primarily as a means of discharging deeply held, hard-to-release emotions and returning patients to a natural, healthy, organic pulsation. So I know that was a lot. I'll pause there.
Well, maybe, you know, I think it might be helpful for the listener to think about when someone's thinking about therapy. So it sounds like you're describing one type of therapy that people think about as this kind of general idea of what therapy is talk therapy. But you're really talking about a type of therapy that really focuses on talk and touch.
Yes.
Right. And how do you compare the two? Because clearly you feel that this type of therapy that you do is has great benefits to a person with the addition of the touch component, right? So how do you think about, how do you compare the two and the strengths of kind of the touch and the touch component to what you do?
It's such an important question. And if we look at the question itself, it comes from the Western mind. And what I mean by that is it comes from the mind that most of us grew up with, including me, that the mind and the body are somehow separate, that psychotherapy and psychology is about the mind and medicine is about the body. And somehow these things are separate or can be artificially bifurcated or separated. What Reich found, and I say that, you know, he's widely considered the pioneer, but let's keep in mind that lots of ancient traditions, practices, and definitely indigenous cultures have known and practiced mind-body work and medicine and rituals for eons. So for the Western Eurocentric white mind, this is sort of novel and new. And so when you say, you know, what are the benefits or how does this work, the talk versus the body, biopsychotherapy, working on the body or vice versa, really what Reich emphasized and was insistent on is that the mind and the body are one functional unit. And he didn't artificially separate them. So just like Aristotle thought and said and taught, when we affect the mind, even if it's through talking, we're affecting the body. When we affect the body, we're affecting the mind. Now, increasingly, modern medicine knows this. You know this because when we are conducting talk therapy, we are changing the neurology, neurotransmitters, the biochemistry of a person's body. Conversely, medication, surgeries, interventions on the body change one's mind. So we know increasingly and intuitively people know this is one and the same.
Okay. So what would be a typical process that you would go through with a client?
A typical session looks like, let's say there's a typical 50-minute session, and I'm giving you an average bell-shaped curve typical idea, but there are certainly variations. Typically, though, to answer your question, the patient comes in, and I've already oriented them to the biophysical work, so they know about that. We talk for a bit. Typically, we're talking for a bit. During this time, I'm very carefully monitoring what's happening with them in their bodies. So I'm noticing twitches in their cheeks. I'm noticing when they say a word that the corners of their mouth are downturned for just a flash. I notice maybe a quick, gleeful smile flash across their face, unbeknownst to them. I may make mention of this.
And what insight does that give you?
So for instance, it tells me maybe that they're unconsciously hiding something. It could be a gleeful, revengeful, vengeful smile that just flashes. It gives me information that they're not, the words, because our minds can trick us and deceive even. The body doesn't, what Reich said was, the body doesn't lie, words can lie. So what that tells me is there's something else going on. Or for instance, lately, because I've been doing everything by video during this pandemic, what's happened frequently is I will just notice a patient with a hard swallow, clenched mouth, and I can see that there's a flash of sadness across their eyes, and then they will keep talking and sharing their narrative. I may say to the patient by video, you know, when you said, and then I'll repeat it as verbatim as best I can, I saw the corners of your mouth downturned, like you were just about ready to cry. That acknowledgement alone can be enough to bring forth that emotional release for the patient and to bring them in greater contact with themselves. So that is an example of what that information tells me and how I use it. So the first part of a typical session would be that, what your listeners are likely familiar with, followed by, at some point, I will move the patient to it looks like a mat in my office. It's a high density foam mat covered in upholstery, about the size of a twin size bed. Sometimes patients who are accustomed to this work might say, I feel like I want to move to the mat. Move them over there. They are in some state of disrobing. So this is another piece that makes it incumbent on me and the therapists who do this kind of work. We really need to have done our own work because we are in close proximity, touching our patients, and they are sometimes in a state of being quite disrobed. Women might be just in a sports bra and panties or yoga shorts or yoga pants. You know, guys often are just in boxer briefs or their underwear. This allows me to see the movement of energy through the body, flushing in the body, where there's hypertonia, meaning stiff, tight muscles, or where there's flaccidity. So I will then work with the patient, instructing them in a certain way of breathing, maybe vocalizing, all depending on what is called their character structure. And then I will intervene. I may, a very common intervention would be turning their head to the side with my hands, pressing with my thumb at the insertion point of the masseter muscle. For your listeners, this is the point. The masseter is that muscle that allows your jaw to move up and down, and I will press in at a 90-degree angle right where, kind of behind, between your ears and your eyes, right below that bone. And I'll press hard while I'm forcing the mouth open. Often the patient will scream or cry, and this will result in a release. For patients with bruxism, chronic, tightening of the jaw and clenching and grinding of the teeth at night, this can be a major, major relief. And they will find that they're no longer doing that once they release what has been held there. So I know I'm talking a lot. What else can I tell you?
I think it's important to discuss, this is a very different type of therapy than someone would expect, right? People expect to keep distance from their therapist, to not have this component of touch associated with it. I think it might be important to talk about, a patient comes to you because they are aware that this is the type of therapy that would be helpful to them, right?
Yeah.
You give them a lot of background. So the question is, how do people come to understand that this might be a helpful type of therapy for them? How do they even decide that this might be a benefit?
It's a really good question. And I can answer it from my own research, which I did years ago, I talked to a number of people who have engaged in this therapy as part of a research study I did to determine why did they even want this therapy, how did they find out about it, that sort of thing. What is a typical path to finding me and this therapy is people have usually self-vetted or self-referred. They have done research. They are usually seekers, people who are really looking for deep, deep work. They're looking for way more than symptom reduction. They're looking for change, genuine change, not just intellectual insight. They may have been in therapy before. They may be folks who are going on psycho-spiritual retreats. They may be people who have aspired to grow and develop themselves. Often they have, at some point in their travels and in their readings, stumbled upon this work. Then they will seek it out. I'm one of three practitioners who do this work in its pure form in all of Los Angeles. So it's hard to find practitioners who really do this. So that's a typical way people will find me, and they will specifically seek me out for that. Now, on the other hand, folks will often come to me because they have some sort of symptom that they want to deal with. This could be depressive symptoms, anxiety symptoms, eating, disordered eating, often sexual issues, relational issues. These sorts of things, these are common. People will go to, a variety of therapists, and mental health practitioners for things like this. When they come to me for that, at some point, if I think it's would be beneficial to add the biophysical work to the treatment, I start talking to them about it. Typically, if they're caught in their bodies, there has been trauma and they've had a hard time releasing it, that indicates that the biophysical work would be beneficial. The other piece that I typically look for where I think, oh, this would be really good for this person, is when I see a personality disorder or features of a personality disorder.
Mm-hmm. And maybe for the listener, describe a little bit more what that is.
The personality disorders are unique among the mental health diagnoses in that they are what are called, I'm going to use a clinical term, egosyntonic. So for your listeners, what that means is the person with a personality disorder or a disordered personality will experience it as, well, this is just how I am. You know, I tend to be really meticulous and controlling. Or, you know, I'm really opinionated and this is just how I am. Or I'm very emotional and I like a lot of attention and I'm very attention seeking. But they don't experience it that it's something that is a problem. However, the unique piece about, and your listeners will get this, about personality disorders is it's a problem for everybody else. So it may not be a problem for the patient, but it's a problem for everyone else. So we've got 10 personality disorders. I'll list a few, your listeners will know. Narcissism, narcissistic personality. Most of us have some understanding of what that is. Histrionic, very attention-seeking, needing to be the center of attention. Dependent, folks who cling. Avoidant personality, folks who are shy, perhaps, and retiring and moving away. There's paranoid personality, borderline personality disorder. Many people have heard of this. Antisocial. There are 10 in total. So typically, someone with a personality disorder will not come into treatment because they experience it as simply, this is who they are. What brings them into treatment is a secondary reason. They're depressed. They're anxious. They are having some sort of trouble managing substance use, gambling. They're having some sexual problems, something like that. Or they have someone in their life who has said, you know what? I'm not dealing with you anymore. I'm leaving you. I'm leaving the relationship unless you go to therapy. These are usually the reasons that the folks with personality disorders end up in my office.
Got it. Okay. And how does the body work help with that, with particular personality disorders?
This gets into some of the theory around character. And Reich's intellectual and research trajectory, let me just say a little bit about that. He, again, started in a very typical psychoanalytic way, the way most of us understand Freud, and your listeners will have some idea of what that is, where the patient is lying on a couch, on their back, and the analyst, the psychoanalyst, is sitting behind the couch. Well, what Reich found was no matter what interpretations he might offer, no matter how well the patient might be able to free associate in the psychoanalytic encounter, they weren't getting better. And he found that he needed to confront the overall defense that was preventing them from really going deeper. And I could say a lot more about that, but I'm just going to cut to the chase. he ended up doing something at the time that was revolutionary, that today is absolutely standard practice that we see in every Hollywood depiction of psychology. And that is, he moved his chair from behind the psychoanalytic couch to the side so that he could see the patient and the patient could make eye contact with him. This was revolutionary, and yet he was the first to do it. And as we know, this is standard practice now, but no one knew, we're not taught in our training that he's the one who did that first. So he came out in front of the couch and he would confront the patient on their overall way of being, not what they were saying, but how they were saying it, being glib, being sarcastic, being controlling, being ingratiating and obsequious and retiring, or whatever it might be, being overly trusting, being untrusting. He would confront the patient. He found that this resulted in physical changes, and especially changes in the patient's sexual functioning. So, to your question about personality disorders and the biophysical work, what happens is the character structure, let's say narcissism, this tight, controlling, domineering, opinionated, phallic need to overpower others. Okay. We don't have to look far for representatives of this in our government. So we have this kind of person, and they're not going to move and they're not going to change. This is how they are. They like it. They get accolades for it. They run roughshod over people. But underneath of that is an emptiness and a lack of self. When I start this person breathing, this kind of person breathing, vocalizing, and then, like, for instance, I might press on their masseter if that's indicated, and they yell and scream. After that, there may be a full body sobbing, and they have a memory of something, and part of them comes back online. And over time, this dissolution of the body armor lets them return home to themselves and relinquish this. It's not really a relinquishing, because they're going to hold tight to it as long as they can. But eventually, there will be a return to themselves and a dissolving away of the body armor that was holding in place that, for instance, narcissistic character structure.
But that is a process. That is quite a long process.
It is a long process. We've got cognitive behavioral therapies. We've got all sorts of different therapies that are much more focused on symptom reduction or even solution oriented. And these would be quick for symptom reduction. The work that I do does tend to be long-term, deep characterological change. So, and folks have to have a certain amount of what I would call ego strength, meaning they've got to have some real tenacity and some real willingness to dig deep and to really want to change. It's not a quick fix. I wish it were. I don't know how to make it a quick fix. It is a process for sure. Yeah.
And you mentioned earlier trauma. And I would assume that people who have different experiences of trauma in their background, in their childhood, or, you know, other parts of their lives, may be hesitant to initiate a type of therapy that includes touch.
That would make sense, especially if the trauma were of a corporeal, and it often is, you know, body boundary violation nature, you know, sexual abuse, sexual molestation, physical abuse, that sort of thing. Let me share this. When someone walks in, when I do an intake over the phone and then someone meets me for the first time in my office or now via video, but typically in the office, I am not going to put that person on the mat during the first session or the second or probably the third, fourth, fifth, or sixth. It may take a month and a half, 6 months. It might be longer before it comes up or it makes sense. As with any therapy, whether it be, you know, psychiatry, psychology, any counseling, any therapy, the relationship is what matters. So I've got to have that abiding relationship first. And then with that, the patient can move over to the mat and feel the fear sometimes of just lying down, you know, partially disrobed while there I am, the doctor, sitting on my chair. It's a stool that moves around, but I sit on this stool next to them, you know, a few feet away. I may not even have to touch them. Just the fact that I'm present there can be enough to get them. They may start crying or they may tighten up and realize this is what happens when they lie down or they're feeling vulnerable. So for the person with a background, you know, with a trauma, a lot of trauma in their lives, background with trauma, there can be a desire, an innate knowingness that they want to move over to the mat, but also a lot of fear. And I help them initially, you know, I would acknowledge that fear and work with that first.
That in itself could be very therapeutic.
Absolutely. You know, I don't have some protocol. It's all about contact and being as present as I possibly can for that patient. In the research that I did, I found among the people I interviewed, and I have found it anecdotally in my own practice, people typically are attracted to this form of therapy intuitively. They will say things like, I just know this is what I need. I've tried other things. I just know I have to do this. There's some knowingness that transcends the cognitive mind. And, you know, we do research or we dismiss it or we privilege the mind or we focus on behaviors. I don't profess to know how all this works. I think we're so in the infancy of understanding the human mind and spirit, psychology, psychiatry. So I don't know how it works. I just know that people will say, I just intuitively felt this was right for me. So even if they have a trauma background and they're scared, they will feel like, you know what? I've got to get over there on that mat. I've got to see what this is all about.
Okay. Right. And I know you work with couples as well as individuals. So how does this play out in your work with couples?
I do work with couples as well as groups and adult families. And with couples, I'm not doing biophysical work with them, but I am doing character analytic work. So really the two pieces that Reich brought to the field of psychology are character analysis, and he has his seminal book is by that name, and the biophysical work. And those are functionally equivalent and they go together. When I work with a couple or an adult family, I'm only doing the character analytic work. So I wouldn't be doing biophysical work on the mat with that couple or with that adult family. But like I said earlier, let's say I notice something in the patient, one of the, you know, partner's bodies or a facial expression, a chronic furrowing of the brow. I will bring attention to that. I will interpret that. I may connect it with what they said at the time that flashed across their face, and then it'll help them return to it and potentially release it. Now, when I work in groups, and I don't have a group going right now, but I did have a process group going for 7.5 years, and it ended a few years ago. I would do biophysical work. And what that looked like was I might work on one person in the group while everyone else observed. This could be enormously powerful because people were able to watch other people do their work and either to identify and relate to it or to understand that person more deeply if it didn't necessarily resonate with them. So I love doing the biophysical work in a group setting. It's extremely powerful.
Interesting. Another question I have is just if we could go over just the different types of somatic under the somatic therapy umbrella and what kind of how someone can approach thinking about the different types of therapies that are out there.
As I said earlier, ergonomic therapy, also called orgone therapy, based on the work of Wilhelm Reich, is the that would be a foundation for all other somatic or body-oriented therapies that sprang from it. And I can speak, most knowledgeably about ergonomic therapy. Probably the next closest would be bioenergetics. And this is based on the work of Alexander Lowen, who was one of Reich's patients. So he was heavily influenced by Reich. He employs a lot of the same work. There's a little bit more focus on the body and less on character, the character analytic approach, which is the talk approach that I had mentioned and that I employ. So in bioenergetics, there may be standing exercises and different movements that are incorporated into the therapy. Whereas Reich was very clear that we work from the ocular segment, the top, down to the pelvic segment. There are seven segmental segments of armoring: the ocular, the oral, the cervical, which would be the neck, thoracic, diaphragm, abdomen, pelvis. So Reich was clear that you don't work on the lower segments until the upper segments are open and in contact. Contact meaning some sort of energetic movement so the person can feel themselves, others, the environment, and ultimately the cosmos. In bioenergetics, there may be work on the lower segments earlier on. So that's a difference. There's also Hakomi. I'm not familiar with Hakomi, so I can't speak knowledgeably about that. There is Feldenkrais, which is often, I know a lot of dancers will, navigate and migrate toward that. What has more recently come into vogue is Peter Levine's work, Somatic Experiencing. And that work focuses on the body, but in more of a talking about it way, bringing the patient. So the therapist there is more bringing the patient's attention to the body by using words, whereas I would bring the patient's attention to the body, both with words and with my hands. So those are some of the differences. And there are also overlaps. I tend to work in a very pure way, according to how Reich originally conceptualized his work. I've stayed close to that. That's how I was trained. But I will also use behavioral interventions or make psychoanalytic interpretations. And I know your viewers might be going, what's he talking about? But things like, I might just focus on activities of daily living, like eating and sleeping and getting out and taking a walk, and exercise, just behavioral or cognitive interventions, looking at one's cognitive distortions. So all of it comes into play.
Right. And I think you make a good point, because in this podcast, it's really great to be able to interview different therapists and psychologists about their specialties. And they all work slightly different, you know, in different ways. But at the same time, there is a similarity across the board that you really meet the patient where they're at and kind of help them, you know, focus on whatever needs to be focused on, whether it's the behavioral component, right, whether it's kind of more of a deeper, you know, intellectualized kind of insight related component. It really depends on the patient. And yes, there are different but there, you know, in many ways are similarities between all different modalities of therapy.
Absolutely.
And the way that therapists and psychologists might work.
And I think that those of us who do this kind of work and have been called to it, a common feature is we care and we want to help people. And whatever way we can do that, we will do it.
Well, going back to, I mean, just a few things to wrap up. How does somebody find and think it, when they think, okay, I really am interested in this type of somatic type of therapy? Is there a good resource? Is there an online resource that they can do to find clinicians who practice this type of therapy? Or, you know, what's a good resource?
I immediately want to say, go to our website.
Well, that will be on there for sure. Yeah.
Sad to say, what I would say to, you know, to your listeners is, there isn't some sort of universal directory. What I can tell you is there is, you know, you can Google or you can, you know, search on orgone therapy, O-R-G-O-N-E, orgonomic therapy. You might want to use the term Reich, R-E-I-C-H, R-E-I-C-H, yeah. Any of those. And in your local area, you could also look up somatic therapy or somatic psychology. You could contact schools of psychology that have a somatic program and ask them for referrals. You know, some of their graduates, that would be another option. Unfortunately, is a little bit of a wild goose chase, and it's hard to find folks who really know what they're doing. What I would say to your listeners is you want to work with someone who is a licensed mental health professional, because if you're entrusting your mind and your body, and your mind-body as one whole unit, holistic unit, to another person's intervention, you want to know that they're properly trained and that they are licensed. I think this is important, and you just want to vet that person, and because, you know, you're entrusting them with a lot and you want to make sure that they know what they're doing. So ask questions and listen to your, as best you can, listen to your body's wisdom. And listen to your heart, listen to your intuition, ask yourself, do I like this person? Do I feel like this person gets me? Do I feel like I can let down and really do deep work with this person's guidance and expertise?
Mm-hmm. Right. Good point. Yeah. So it sounds like, you know, people can, there's not, like you said, there's not some directory that, you know, guides people to, guides the, you know, the person interested in services. It's kind of, you just have to check out, make sure that they have appropriate credentials. And a lot of times when you're thinking about therapists, it's really about the fit that you experience with the person in the room when you go in to talk to a therapist for the first time, and kind of the feeling you get and the sense that you're really getting what you need from the therapy. So it's a kind of a tricky thing to navigate sometimes, but it's kind of that feeling of, whether or not that therapist is just a right fit for you or not.
It is a tricky thing to navigate because it's a catch-22. What I've said to people who have contacted me and said, you know, how do I find a good therapist? Like, you know, and you just ask that question, how do you find a good somatic therapist? Well, if you already are relatively unarmored and in contact with yourself and able to feel what feels like a good connection and a good appropriate contact, you've already sort of done a lot of the work that the therapy is intended to address. So when I ask people, well, be in touch with how you feel when you talk to your therapist, well, the therapy is often a lot about getting in touch with that. So it's a catch-22 because I'm basically encouraging people to be in contact with themselves when they talk to a therapist on the phone, a potential therapist on the phone, and yet the therapy is intended to help them get in contact with themselves. So which comes first? Right.
If only they could just, their future self could help give some insight into that.
Exactly.
Right. Well, I think we do have to wrap up, but is there anything that we didn't go over that you think might be very helpful?
I think that the somatic therapies are definitely on the cutting edge of where people want to go. And we know that complementary and alternative medicine is definitely on the increase. We know that people are seeking holistic forms of treatment and intervention and pulling together their own cadre of health providers and wellness providers that transcends, you know, the typical going to your general practitioner physician. So I know that this is definitely something people are looking for, and I'm really happy you had me on to talk about it. And I love talking about this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it's helpful for me too to just kind of understand this a little bit more fully. I will make sure that on the episode description, there will be for sure your website. And I think there's some helpful information just on that website by itself. And hopefully people can use that as maybe a starting point to learn a little bit more about that therapy if that's something that they're interested in.
I think so. I think it'd be a good place to start. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you being on, Neil, and take care.
Thank you. I loved it.
All right.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Be well. Bye.
Bye.
This has been Mind Stories. With remote appointments in California and offices in downtown Los Angeles, Santa Monica, Hermosa Beach, Marina Del Rey, and Echo Park, Cal Psychiatry specializes in medication management, mood and anxiety disorders, alternative therapies, women's mental health, and more to help you get back to your true self. Visit us at calpsychiatry.com. Thank you for listening to Mind Stories, and don't forget to subscribe.